And so to be a compounder is someone who actively seeks to make the choices today that their future self will thank them for. So it's that long-term thinking perspective. If you're not finding your breaking point, you're not pushing yourself hard enough. You need to push yourself to find your breaking point and then figure out how to get better, come back, and push through it again. 99% of the population would probably quit right now. What do I need to do to keep driving, keep going, stay focused, and complete the mission? And so many people, as soon as they hit an obstacle, think, oh, this is a sign, I'm not meant to do this, or this is too difficult, and they don't push through and complete the mission.
We're like, look, what we do is not cheap. We find most economical ways, we find most inexpensive ways, but we don't do cheap. So Justin, for those who don't know you, what does it mean to be a compounder? What does the term mean? And how did you come up with it?
Yeah, I heard the term compound interest. You put money in the bank and your interest makes interest on your interest and it just keeps accumulating. Fully believe that life works the same way and every decision we make today will determine the lives we live tomorrow. How I'm living now in my 30s is a culmination of all the decisions that I made throughout my 20s, and how I live my 40 will be a determination of all the decisions that I continue making throughout my 30s. So every decision that we make compounds. And so to be a compounder is someone who actively seeks to make the choices today that their future self will thank them for. So it's that long-term thinking perspective.
Is there a way to learn that principle? How did you decide that you are the compounder and that this is the mantra that you're going to be
using? Yeah, anyone use it in that perspective. Compound interest, obviously. The compound effect, there is the book. You know, I didn't even know there was a book called The Compound Effect, and a buddy sent it to me and I read it. He had the same thought process and everything. But no, I think I've just always known that. Oh, I've looked at people that were older, successful people and unsuccessful people. The biggest differentiating factor is how they spent their time and the decisions that they made in the process. And so when I was deciding to start doing life and fitness coaching, I really liked this concept. To be honest, it just kind of came to me one night, the compound effect, compounding coach and everything like that. For someone to adopt the mindset, they have to get rid of, most people have this instant gratification mindset. And I think that's really important, especially in the development world. It takes time to develop a project. It could take 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 years, depending on the magnitude of the project. So you can't have this instant gratification mindset. So you need to learn to adopt. I'm going to make some decisions today. There might not be any results, or you might not see any gratification of those decisions for long term down the road. And that's huge in real estate, especially when you're talking long-term appreciation. And so if you can learn to get that shift in your mind, you will learn to start making choices today that your future self will thank you for. And you'll also start learning to adopt the mindset that you need to have to really be successful in real estate as well. That would be the biggest push right there, is just start thinking of, okay, what can I do today? And that my future self will look back and say, hey, I'm glad you made that decision. And now my life is a little bit better off because of that decision.
Right. Yeah. So it's all about the mindset and how you approach thinking, the basic principles that we already know, but you've got a little bit of a different twist to it.
Yeah.
So I have a question. You've done Ironman's 100-mile ultra, built multiple businesses. Where does your drive come from?
Really, it just comes from constantly pushing the envelope. You know, I'm a fan of, I'm trying to find my breaking point. I feel like I've been going through my life and I just want to find my breaking point. And when you're searching for your breaking point, you keep accomplishing higher and higher levels. I think it just comes from being in the military. I didn't want to just be in the Army. I wanted to push the limit. So I went to Ranger school, got earned the Army Ranger tab, did that, got out and kept pushing. I got into triathlons and I went from sprints to Olympics. Then I did a half Ironman. Then I did a full Ironman. And then I was like, man, I'm still not there yet. I'm going to go do a 100-mile old. And, you know, I won third place and it wasn't really that difficult. So I'm like, now, okay, what's the next limit? And for me, that drive just kind of comes from wanting to constantly achieve and keep pushing the limit. And now being a coach and having a following of people that are watching me, a huge amount of my drive is, I would say at least 1 to 5 times a day, someone is reaching out to me. People that I went to high school with, people that I haven't seen in 10, 15 years have been following me. They're messaging me saying, hey, Justin, I just want you to know, like, we haven't talked in 10 years, but I've been watching your journey and it's motivated me to start making changes in my life. And so if I can be that spark that puts a little fire in someone else's life, then that's a main part of where my drive comes from, to be that spark to spark someone else's fire.
Spark someone else's fire. Help me understand. So you're trying to find that breaking point, but what happens when you do?
You learn where your limits are, and then you learn if you're not finding your breaking point, you're not pushing yourself hard enough. You need to push yourself to find your breaking point and then figure out how to get better, come back, and push through it again. It's not a matter of like, hey, I hit my point and now I'm done and like, this is it. No, it's like, okay, now I know where that threshold is. Now I need to learn how to train myself better, get myself more mentally right, whatever and whatever. Sometimes it's not always physical stuff. Sometimes it's mental stuff. It's raising a family. It's working a job. It's working three jobs. It's working three jobs and trying to maintain your fitness and trying to maintain a faith. So in life, we're always going to find those breaking points, but it's how you come back and attack it and keep driving and persevering. I've hit my points where, not necessarily my breaking point where I've had to quit, but I've reached many points throughout my journeys where it's like, man, 99% of the population would probably quit right now. What do I need to do to keep driving, keep going, stay focused, and complete the mission? And so it's all about being able to push yourself and figure out how to complete the mission, no matter how difficult it is.
How to complete the mission. I relate in the way that whenever I find in the business world, whenever I find this major obstacle that I cannot overcome, my mind starts going in places of, okay, well, if I can't directly overcome this obstacle, what can I do to go around it? And then I try to find these lateral shifts. How do I go back, regroup? How do I achieve that? If the direct path is not possible, is there another option? Is there another route? So I guess it's a similar way of thinking.
That's how you differentiate the doers from the don't. You know, those that will complete it and those that won't is, you know, a lot of people, you know, here's where they are right now and here's where their objective is. And they think it's a straight linear path, but you're going to hit objectives and you're going to go out this way. Then you got to find a way to come back and keep going. And you're going to go out this way. So you got to figure out how to zigzag and get yourself to that final objective. And so many people, as soon as they hit an obstacle, think, oh, this is a sign, I'm not meant to do this, or this is too difficult, and they don't push through and complete the mission. You got to have that mindset of like, hey, this is where I'm at, this is where I need to be, and no matter how much of this I do, I'm going to get here, no matter what it takes. And that's the mindset you need to adopt.
Excellence. Taking it to the real estate world, one of your businesses is short-term rentals, Airbnbs. Walk us through your first deal. What did you learn the hard way? How did that happen? How did you solve challenges? And what was the end result?
A passion for real estate. After I got out of the Army, four-bedroom house. I went to Arizona State University, four-bedroom house, rock camping, pool. I didn't want to pay rent, so I went to school. I wanted to live for free, and I did. I bought the house. It was, you know, $160,000 house with a low interest rate. My mortgage was like $700, $800 a month. Should have kept that house. But hey, I was able to rent rooms out and I cash flowed. It paid my mortgage, paid my utilities, and I made about $400 or $500 a month on top of that for 3 years. After I graduated with my undergrad, I sold the house for a $78,000 tax-free profit. I was also running door-to-door sales teams and I'm making really good money at that. So I had a pretty good chunk of money saved up. They say your network is your net worth. Mentors have people. So I had a mentor that had just bought an Airbnb in Gatlinburg, Tennessee in the Smoky Mountains, which is one of the most traveled to national parks in the country. He had bought it in 2019 and was killing it. And he showed me the numbers and he's like, bro, you should buy one. You should buy one. You should buy one. And finally I like looked and analyzed his numbers and I was like, man, yeah, I should probably buy one. I started the search process and ended up buying my first cabin out there for $270,000. I was always smart. I always claimed taxes. I always paid a lot of money in taxes. I always had my debt to income ratios so I could qualify for properties. Sucked. I had to pay a lot of money in taxes, but I made a lot of money because of it. So bought my first Airbnb and I bought it. I closed on it March 5th, 2020. I bought it, put about $10,000 into it, renovated it, fixed it up, cleaned it up, put it on the market right at the end of March, early April, started getting bookings. Had my first booking and then the world shut down. I was like, man, what did I just do? I thought I just threw my money away. But it was actually really cool because I was living in South Carolina, not too far away at the time. And when the world shut down, I was like, well, I got nothing to do. So I spent 3 months living in my cabin. I had a hot tub, video game systems, arcade machines. I was living my best life. It was pretty fun. Well, did we know what we were in store for though? When COVID was over, this was the best thing that could have happened. Like, this market. Everybody was tired of sitting at home, and those that had money and wanted to travel still wanted to travel. International travel was over. People were still scared to go places. So they were like, why not go to the Smoky Mountains, rent a really awesome Airbnb with the family where we can vacation and travel, but still be isolated in a cabin? And so that market just exploded. We were shut down for 3, 4 months of the summer. The 2020 rents were almost double the 2019 and 18 and 17 rents. I mean, it was insane. And so that I literally by we picked back up in May, June, and then come October, I was already buying my second cabin out there. So that was my experience on my Airbnb that I'd bought.
Sounds like a positive experience. Would you attribute it mostly to luck, or did you plan on contingencies? Obviously, nobody could plan on COVID, but what type of risk analysis did you do before you bought it?
I was looking at the numbers of my buddy's cabin, and his cabin had been a rental for, 10, 15 years. And I'd looked at the numbers, and it always made stable income. It wasn't like the sexiest returns. I mean, it was really good. So that rental market, the thing about Gatlinburg, Pigeon Forge, Dollywood, yeah, there are thousands and thousands of overnight rentals, and they've been there since the 80s and 90s. Cabin rental companies ruled them. You'd buy the cabin and then give it to one of the cabin rental agencies, and they would rent it for you. Airbnb kind of exploded at the fact that you could own or operate and self-manage it and really stand out and cut out the 20% you got to pay the companies. So I was running it, and even at the most conservative numbers, it would cash flow, pay its expenses, and I might make a little bit of money. I was probably going to just play the appreciation aspect on it. I think COVID was going to happen. I think it was going to blow up. No, that first cabin I bought, when I bought it, it was doing about 40, 45. I think the expenses were around like 30,000-ish, 32. So, you're making 10, 15K a year. That year in 2020, I bought it. I only had it on the rental market. By the time COVID, from June to December, I made like 70K. I added 30K with less than half the year. In 2021, it was pushing 80, 90K a year in rentals. I bought another one and it snowballed. I ended up buying a total of six of them. In 21, that market got so crazy. This was when interest rates were like 3%. The returns, this market was exploding. These cabins were doing 100K a year in rentals. So all these cash buyers were selling their properties, 1030 their money into this market. It was every property that hit the market within an hour of being on the market, it would be $50,000 over asking with 20, 30 offers, all cash. And it was just insane trying to buy. I found a niche where I made the money. Basically, all the turnkey rental properties were going. But there were cabins that had Airbnbs all around them. These people were like, we're old, retired, we're going to sell, move to Florida. None of the investors wanted them because they needed to be converted. So I was buying them for what seemed like pennies on the dollar at the time. And then I would move into them and I'd live there for about 3, 4 months and convert them. And, they had certain criteria that I looked for. I had to be able to build epic game rooms, tiled walk-in showers. And then me and my buddy found a niche. Nobody was doing this. We invented this. All the cabins out there have it now. We started building mini golf courses at all the Airbnbs. Every Airbnb I bought had to have flat land, at least a half an acre. We'd build really awesome putt-putt mini golf courses, epic game rooms, hot tubs, fire pits. I was buying these properties for 500,000. Then I would convert them. I'd put 80 grand into them. I'd put them on Airbnb for 6 to 7 months. I'd get my 80 grand back out of it. I'd have $120,000 on the books, and then I'd sell them for 800, 900 grand 7 months after purchasing it. And so that was the niche. I got into flipping Airbnbs. That was really cool.
Who were the buyers? Were they investors that would also run it as Airbnbs, or were they people that would just own the vacation home?
Airbnb. And so what they were buying, they were investors. Pretty much every single one of them was a 1031. Like one of them I sold for 950. I bought it for 500 grand, sold it for 950 grand 6 months later. And it was an all cash deal. They bought it cash. And when I sold it to them, it had $120,000 on the books. So they got to assume my bookings. They gave me 950 grand and I gave them 120 grand in rents right away. Good deal for them. At the time, it was investors, not vacationers, not at that pricing.
How did you finance all these acquisitions?
I wasn't doing DSRC loans, but they were basically like DSRC loans. The local in that area, they knew the market so well, and they could run the rents they could basically qualify you off the projected rents of the property. Since the interest rates were so, you know, we're buying at 3 to 4% with the rates being what they were and what the projected rents were, they were enough to cover it. So as long as you had the 20% to put down on the property, they looked at my portfolio. They looked at me. They said, okay, you have 3 or 4 properties out here in the area that are cash flowing. They looked at my cash reserves in the bank, having the money to put the 20% down. And then they were able to qualify you based off the projected Airbnb rental rents. So it was essentially they were doing DSCR loans without it actually being a DSCR loan.
And you're talking about debt service coverage ratio loans,
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
Factors in the income. Okay, perfect. Tell me about your biggest oh no moment in real estate. Something negative, something that taught you a lesson.
Biggest, I've bought 13 properties. I flipped 13 properties. My average return for those 13 properties is $257. You know, I haven't really had a bad experience except for I sold all my Airbnbs. I don't like Airbnb as a company anymore. The rents predicted them going down and I sold at the peak of the market and walked away. I took all the cash and now I'm doing full on fix and flips, like buying properties, cash, self-funding and doing the full renos. And I would say my first property that I bought was probably got myself a little in over my head as far as repairs and what it needed. It was pretty rough and we ended up tearing pretty much the entire house down. It was a full reno and I definitely misjudged how much money I was going to have to put into it. And so that one wasn't that big. Like I said, my averages are in that 250 range. This one, I only made like 20 grand on it because I ended up having to put so much into it. And so we went inside, ripped it to the studs. We had to redo the joists. We had to redo the beams. I wasn't expecting to put a roof on. We had to put a roof. We had to put siding. It was a full rehab. And so, yeah, I would say the biggest thing is just, you know, really, really know what you're getting into. Walk the property with your contractors and be ready. Luckily, I had the money. I ran the numbers. It still made money, but not as much as it was worth the headache of dealing with all of that.
If you were to do it again, what would you do different? Would you not buy the property or
no.
What kind of research would you do to prepare?
I would look at the full picture. So it's like, okay, so now when I buy properties, you know, again, you don't really know what you're getting into, especially these cash deals that if it's a good deal, you're fighting 5, 10 other people to try to buy it. You're competitive. It's quick. Sometimes you don't even get a chance to walk the property. It's as is. Hey, I'm closing in 7, 8 days. No, like there's not even a point in having an inspection or anything like that because the inspector's just going to walk in and be like, yeah, dude, this thing's jacked up. So I basically run the numbers. Now what I do is I run the numbers as if I have to rebuild the house, but not as a new build cost, but as a rehab cost, roof, HVAC, hot wash, flooring, stuff, what my costs are going to be. I run the numbers that way at full rehab plus the purchase price and then what my projected sales price is at minus 15% and see if that breaks even. If it breaks even at that point, then it's worth it because I'm doing a couple things. One, I'm rehabbing a house, keeping my contractors busy so they're happy. You know, if I could break even, that's a win. And I'm providing a house back to the community. And that's absolutely worst case scenario. What I found is when I run it that way, 15 to 20% below my already conservative sales price, complete full rehab, and I run my break even number, then now I'm finding myself ending up in pretty good scenarios where they're, you know, $100,000 plus profits because I end up not having to do half that stuff. That's how I run my numbers now.
I'm glad it pencils for you. With my projects, every time I try to run numbers super conservatively, a lot of times I pencil myself out and the job doesn't make sense because costs are too high. When I run all of these contingencies, what is the worst case that can happen on all of these fronts and then go even more conservative? A lot of times we say, well, then we can't do the deal. I found that we have to find some compromises, assume some risk is going to happen, and then we figure out ways to mitigate those risks. Are you finding something similar?
Price. I just recently got my real estate license just for, you know, my residential license just to I hate dealing with agents who 9 times out of 10, I know more than they do. I can write the contract. I'm doing the negotiating anyways. I got my license since this is how I've gotten my last couple deals. I'll jump on Zillow and go to the properties that have been listed the longest, right? I'll go down and be like, okay, this property has been listed for 6 months or something like that. And I'll find the jacked up ones that meet all my criteria and check all my boxes. The last one I bought, they're asking $250,000. For it. And I was like, dude, this property's not worth 250 grand. I ran the numbers and at 250 grand, it was break even slash maybe lose a couple grand. So it was like, okay, at 250, it doesn't make sense. And then I was like, okay, at 225 would be a good, decent deal. 200 would be a decent deal. And so the property was just sitting there, and I just went to them and said, hey, obviously you're not selling this property. You've probably been lowballed a bunch of times. Look, I'm an agent. I have cash. I'll give you $180,000 for the property. I actually write up the contract. I don't put an execution date on it. And I just send it to them and let them hold it. And it's like, here, hey, is that? Send them some screenshots of my bank account. And I've done that a couple times. Weeks to a month later, I'll get a call and say, hey, is that offer still good? Yeah, sure. You want to do it? Let's do it. And they say, okay. And so I picked up that deal. They were listed at 300. They were willing to go down to 250. I got it for 180 just because I was able to write up my own offer, show them the cash. Hey, I'm a buyer agent. Here's the properties I bought. And they're like, you know what? All right, screw it. Let's take it. And so that gave me a $70,000. So I was already breaking even at the 250. So then that gave me a $70,000 buffer and ended up not costing me nearly as much to renovate it as I ran the numbers. I'm getting ready to list it. And that property is probably going to make me about 280 grand. And so it's a amazing property, and it turned out really well. I saved over 100 something grand in what I ran on my numbers. So it really worked out.
That sounds amazing. What is your benchmark for profitability, IRR, equity multiple? What do you typically measure?
Yeah, so I got jaded when I was flipping Airbnbs. You know, I was literally getting $300,000-$400,000 every flip 6 months out. So when I went into the conventional world, even when I got my license, I was talking to my broker and I was telling him what I'm expecting and this is what I'm going to do. And he's like, you're not going to do that. Most people are happy to make 10, 15, 20 grand. And I was like, it's not even worth my time if I'm only making 20 grand. So me personally, I won't mess with a property if I don't see an upwards value of being able to profit at least 75 to 100 grand. I got the one I'm getting ready to sell. That one's going to make me at least over 250 grand. And then I've got another one that's in works as well. And that one should probably make about 120 grand. So that's typically, yeah, if I'm not making 75, then I'm not messing with it.
So are you not borrowing any money? You're just acquiring them for cash, all your own cash right now?
Yeah, I do have some people that I can borrow money from. Last year, I bought 4 properties at once. I bought one too many. I was using all my own cash and had a partner who was willing to go in with me on one of them. But for the most part, yeah, it's just, hey, here's my cash. Here's my bottom dollar. I'm not playing games. I'm not going back and forth. No, I don't want you to cut. If it's a dollar more than what I'm offering you, I'm not messing with you. This is my cash price. Purchase it. And then I've got really good contractors that can get in. They take care of me. We do volume. I've done hundreds of thousands of dollars worth of work with them. They get in, they help take care of me. They get the project done. And then, yeah, we're able to at a pretty decent profit. So,
okay. For property owners thinking about developing their own property, what is one mindset shift that they need to make? We started this conversation from mindset, and I want to bring it back full circle back to mindset.
No, like they want to renovate a property kind of like what I'm doing.
I guess I should explain. What we do in our business is we typically partner with property owners and we help them develop it.
Okay.
I'm trying to merge the two concepts of renovation or full tear down or ground up construction. So if somebody has a property, whether it's a tear down or maybe they just bought it for business purposes, what is that mindset that they need to have?
I mean, look, you've got to spend. That's why I've talked to a lot of investors, flippers, built, you know, they want to do it as cheap as possible. They're nervous when it comes time to writing checks. You've got to adopt the mindset like, hey, we're getting ready to get into this. You got to be really willing to write some checks. One thing my contractors always love working with me is they send me an invoice for $40,000 and bam, within an hour, that's in their inbox. Wire sent. Here's your money. 40 grand. No problem. 80 grand. Boom. Here. No problem. You can't bat an eyelash. You can't think about it. Oh, this money's gone. I'm not spending money. I'm just moving it from my bank account into this property. As long as I ran my numbers and did everything right, it's just going to come back to me bigger number. So that's the biggest mindset shift you need to have is not batting an eyelash when it comes to writing these. Now, obviously get your quotes, don't blow money, but don't cheap out either. A lot of people try to do these cookie cutter builds or renos and they're like, I'm going to put $200,000 into this property and I sell it for $250,000. And it's like, okay, cool. Depending on the location and stuff, you could put like dollars into this property and sell it for $350,000. So it's like you could spend, you know, and less and make $50,000 less, or you can spend $50,000 more and make an extra 100 grand. You got to be okay spending money. And that's where I see a lot of people. They say, yeah, contractors deal with it all the time. When it comes time to write the check, they start puckering up and they don't want to write that check. So just get ready to spend. Last year, I took all the money I spent on real estate, divided it by 365, and I spent an average of $4,677 a day. So every morning I woke up, there's $4,700 gone. You just got to get in the mindset where that's what's happening. That would be the biggest shift I would say people need to adopt.
Yeah, in our company, at one point, we spent a lot of time and energy convincing the team to exclude the word cheap from their vocabulary. We're like, look, what we do is not cheap. We find most economical ways, we find most inexpensive ways, but we don't do cheap. Yes, we need to figure out how to save, but yeah, we can't do cheap just because it doesn't work, doesn't sell.
It doesn't, man.
If you could go back and give your younger self one piece of advice about real estate, what do you think it would be?
But like, seriously, that was it, man. I should have bought a couple more long-term rentals. I was so focused during, you know, 2020 to 2023 and four, that era where the interest rates were low. I was buying all Airbnb cabins and stuff like that. I wish I'd bought more residential properties and multifamilies at those interest rates. It's tough right now, you know, especially with the internet. Everybody's all about the easy life and work from home and skiing and how to do all this stuff. So real estate's really gotten competitive, you know, because everybody with a little 401k or Roth IRA is learning how to convert it into hedge funds or syndications, and they're buying this and that. You know, buying properties at the prices with the interest rates right now, it just doesn't make sense to buy duplexes and triplexes. Maybe if you can get into like 30 plus size unit buildings, it makes more sense if you could come up with the funding, but most people don't have the funding for something like that. So the biggest piece of advice I would give my younger self was, you know, that house that I bought, my first house that I bought it for 160 grand and I made 80 grand off of it. I sold it for 220 or 230 or something like that. But I've looked it up recently on Zillow and it's worth like 380, another 150 grand on top of that. And so, you know, I only had a $700 more. I could have rented that house for easily for $1,500 a month. I'd be sitting on 300K equity right now. Any advice I could give a younger person is, if you look at the housing, you know, housing prices go up and down. There's been crashes where there's been big dips. But even when it's going up and down, it's going up, I forget the term, but it's going up and down at an upward trajectory. And so, you know, no matter what, you look at housing prices 10 years ago, 20, 30, 40 years, they're always, every decade, you're acquiring equity. So, I mean, it's never a bad idea to just acquire and hold. So I try to hold the ones I like. I've got a nice property out in Scottsdale, Arizona. I've got a nice one here in Knoxville that I'm holding on to. My advice is to acquire. I should have acquired more at the rates, but you know, even right now, you know, anything you can acquire and hold long. Like I've got one that I bought cash. I'm going to renovate and I'm probably going to just cash out, refi the money I have into the reno. So about 120, 140 grand, I can rent it out and cash flow pretty good. And I'm just going to keep that one, you know? And so maybe out the burr, even the burrs are cool, but even with the interest rates right now, it just makes it tough. You know, you pull that money out and it's sometimes hard to even get the rents to cover what the mortgage is right now in some of these areas and stuff. So that's another factor you got to play in when purchasing a property. Okay, if I burr this property and I want to hold on to it long term, can I pull X amount and still maintain the payments of that property? Sorry, that went on a little tangent, but that
right to cover the debt service.
Yes, you got to cover your debt. Thing to come out of pocket to cover any gap that the renters are not able to cover, you bought the wrong property. If that's going to hurt you, you're not, you know, that's going to hurt your debt to income ratios. That's going to hurt your bottom line. That's not good. So a break even is a win. You know, they say in Vegas, if you walk away with the same money you came there with, that's a win. So yeah, you got to cover that debt service.
Justin Martinez, thank you so much for the conversation. It was super interesting. I love hearing your story and good luck to you, man.
Hey,
all the best.
Hey, I appreciate it. Thank you so much for having me on.
Awesome. Real estate development, land to legacy.